So I think that iconic scents is that there is this hard to describe quality where they become not a smell, but a perfume. And what I mean by that is that they become so much part of one's body that it becomes a person's smell. And you don't know if it's the person's natural smell, where that person's natural smell stops, and when the perfume begins, it becomes one. They blend in one another. So when you work on a candle, it's not a human smell, and it's fine that it's beautiful and maybe comfortable, but it's not human.
Hi, I'm Dan Rubenstein, and this is The Grand Tourist. I've been a design journalist for nearly 20 years, and this is my personalized guided tour through the worlds of fashion, art, architecture, food, and travel, all the elements of a well-lived life. As we approach our 100th episode of the podcast, I'm sure you've learned by now that the worlds of art and design and luxury are shaped by the people who, pardon the cliché, think differently. My guest today came to New York from Paris as a young man, and after initially skirting his family's heritage, he came to revolutionize it. Frederic Malle. Like a great gallerist, curator, or magazine journalist, Frederic, through his company, Édition de Parfums Frederic Malle, doesn't take full credit for its creations. Instead, he publishes them in a sense, elevating the great noses that brought them to life, and giving them full credit as anyone would a star author. Frederic was raised in Paris to a prominent family in the worlds of art and luxury. His maternal grandfather helped create the legendary Miss Dior fragrance in 1947, and his mother worked in the field too. And his father was a highly regarded film producer who worked with Frederic's uncle, Louis Malle. More on that later. After an education at NYU and initially working in advertising, he returned to his roots, eventually taking the most radical leap possible with the 2000 launch of his brand. In the years since, he's produced dozens of scents, some of which have become icons like Portrait of a Lady, French Lover, and others. His latest is Heaven Can Wait by Jean-Claude Elena, described as being a quintessentially Parisian scent with notes of clove, pimento, and carrot seed, and inspired in part by the quote, intimacy of private worlds. To me, Frederic embodies the classic New York success story, combining know-how, street smarts, and lots of chutzpah. I caught up with Frederic from his home on Fifth Avenue to talk about his scented memories of Paris, his ongoing obsession with film, how he launched his own line, the future of gender in the business, and much, much more. I'd love to start at the beginning, and, you know, as someone who was born in Paris to a family that's so intertwined with the cultural life there, I was wondering what your earliest memories are of the city of Paris, and, you know, if you could paint a picture for me of your youth.
We were living in this very large apartment, which was on four floors. And I remember sort of ground floors, the lower floors, it was like a house in the air, really, were very old-fashioned, grand, classical, with classical painting. And then we had our rooms, and there was this planet where my brother and I lived. And so we went from the ground floor, which was very formal, to a penthouse on top, which was extremely modern. And this is probably something that informed me, my taste for the rest of my life, because I lived in classical and futuristic. So it was a bit of a schizophrenic thing, place, although there were two separate worlds. And in my taste today, I mix things. And whether it is in perfumes or other aesthetic things that I make. Now, as for Paris, the one thing that I remember is just walking out of my house was the Knoll boutique that always, Knoll had this very luxurious, unique to Paris showroom, which was run by this very good decorator who would mix Knoll, which looked really almost futuristic at the time, because I was born in the 60s, and more classical things. So yet again, that. And then, you know, my childhood in Paris was really about going to the gardens, to the Tuileries Gardens, walking there, crossing the Seine, and going to see my friends. And then growing up, every morning, taking the subway. And the metro is a very big part of my life in Paris. First of all, it's a fast way to go around the city, and I also use it in New York. But it has this very peculiar smell and this very peculiar sort of feel to it in Paris. And I used to go to school in the metro. And so that's also a memory. So it's really walking through the Tuileries, or the Musée Rodin, taking the subway. And all of this was in Saint-Germain-des-Prés also. So that's also, I mean, all the Saint-Germain-des-Prés has changed, and my Saint-Germain-des-Prés is probably can be seen in my uncle's Louis Malle's movie. What is it called? The Feu Follet, the Fires from Within, I think it's called. It's changed quite a lot.
Do you go back to Paris often?
So when I moved to America, I mean, when I moved again to America, because I have a long story with this country, in 2006, my main office was still in Paris. And I used to go back every month, and it was absolutely exhausting. And so I'd spend 3 weeks here and a week in Paris. I try to do that less, but to spend more time. So I go every other month, I suppose.
And, you know, do you remember, are there any early scents of Paris? We talked a little bit about the metro.
The metro is a huge scent of
really?
Paris.
Really? How do you describe, how would someone such as yourself describe the scent of the Paris metro?
So a lot of people find it disgusting. First of all, it's unique, and I'm very much into unique scents. And it hasn't changed so much. And I think that what people, I mean, this is a bit disgusting. It will sound disgusting to many people. But you know that dust is mostly dried skin because mm-hmm. we sort of shade and we have sort of dry, little pieces of dry skin coming out. And I think it's the smell of dry skin, people's dry skin and people's smell.
Yeah.
And I suppose that there is also the stone that it's made with. It's that odd okay. mixture. So it's a warm smell. It's not a particularly clean smell. But they have not tinkered with it. They have not added or put anything to make it smell good. So it has that identity. And it's this sort of warm, woody, animalic smell by my book. But it's, to me, it's so linked to childhood that each time I get into the metro, and I still do today, I use it quite often. It's sort of, you know, it has this sort of Proustian effect to me. So it's neither good or bad. It's just, it's what it is. It's a thing.
It's better than what we can smell in the New York subway.
Well, it has its smell also. I mean, I used to travel the New York subway with my father when I was a child, and it has its own identity. All these places have their identity, and it's, you know, we sort of, it's easy to look down on them, but they're typical. They are the, you know, they're the sort of, they're a layer in our perception of the city.
So I was wondering, can you explain in your own words your maternal grandfather's link to the history of the business of perfume?
My maternal grandfather, two things that really sort of led him to creating Christian Dior perfume was Christian Dior's childhood friend. They were both brought up in Normandy. And as a very young man, he became the right hand and then the MD, I think, of a man called Coty, who created a company called Coty.
Of course, huge company now.
It's a huge company now, but it was even bigger then. And he was really the inventor of modern perfumery. He was the man that invented most of the chemical architectures of perfumes that we still use today. Most of them were invented by him. He invented, apparently, the duty-free. He was a genius businessman. He invented advertising. He invented a specific bottle that would be associated with a perfume that he used to do with Lalique. He invented windows showing only one thing when people in the days used to show 50 things in a window. He understood the idea of impact and spectacle. And so my grandfather was part of that. And it was probably the best school for perfumery. My grandfather left Coty in the 30s. Coty had a very dark ending and started his own business quite successfully. And when Dior thought of opening his own fashion house, my grandfather proposed to make a perfume right away, even before the new look was even shown. And so Miss Dior was launched, I think, in 1947, just after or during the new look at the same time. I can't remember exactly. It's a few months that are mysterious to me. Anyhow, my grandfather was the founder of Parfum Christian Dior. And also Dior's best friend. So they were, I mean, close childhood friend. So there was this very strong tie. Now, Dior and my grandfather respectively died very, very young. They were 53 and 54, I think, before I was born. And my mother, who was my grandfather's darling, and who was interested in his business, worked at Dior all her life. I used to sort of nickname her Chancy Gardener as the character in Being There, because she never got out of that garden. She worked at Christian Dior for 47 years, and from the age of 18 to 65. And so she didn't know anything else. But her perfumery was very important to her, because it was, I suppose, a tie with her father that she missed terribly. So my brother and I were brought up with the idea that perfume was important, that one should never cut corners, that it was a serious business, that it had to be very artistic. So we had all these values that were communicated to us. Not that our mother would show us very, very specific things in terms of smelling. This is something I learned on my own. But I knew how important it was. And so when I grew up, first of all, I was wearing perfume, which was quite unusual for a child. Second, I was really aware of perfume. And when I discovered Seduction, I understood how important perfume, a role perfume played in, you know, being attracted to someone or being attractive to someone. So quickly, I sort of started wearing Halston and things that were not in the Dior planet, and started creating my own planet. But it was really something that, I mean, I was pointed in the right direction, let's put it this way. It was part of me. But I was not taught very technically. You know, I was never told, this is patchouli, this is rose, this is jasmine. I never had that I learned on my own.
And was the home that you grew up in somewhat of a fragrant one? Home scents were not kind of what they are today, of course, is this whole industry now. But was it, when you think about the home, was there, you know, was it about cooking? Was it about something that your mother wore? Was it anything like that?
So, first of all, many of the sort of smart homes in Paris were using the same fragrance, which was a Guerlain perfume called Potpourri. And it was a perfume that had to burn, that was put on top of light bulbs. Oh, and wow. They discontinued it because it was dangerous and they probably ran into trouble with this. So they had this this perfume diffuser, which was burning the perfume, but it became more complicated and this thing disappeared. But I know that Christian Dior himself used it at his home. Many people in my family had it, and even on my father's side of the family. And my parents' house smelled of that. That was the smell of smart homes in Paris in the 60s. And I also remember my mother's perfume, wearing Miss Dior, Diorissimo and Miss Dior. She sort of went from one to the other as a child. So yes, the fragrances were important. I always loved the smell of cooking. So we had someone cooking for us. And this is something, and when I came back from school, I learned how to cook with that person. I had cooking lessons. And so, those smells were always very important to me.
And in terms of your father, who I believe was working with as a producer with your uncle's films, can you explain, was your childhood, growing up, going to the cinema and watching a lot of films? And I'm sure that must have had some kind of aesthetic impact on you.
Indeed. Very, very much so. So my father was this bigger-than-life character who was indeed my uncle's producer. But before anything, that was like a side job. My father was running the international part of Lehman Brothers. And he was a banker. And when my uncle started working in cinema, my father and Louis started a movie production company, which was called Nouvelles Éditions de Film. And so there's the word édition in this. So Nouvelles Éditions de Film came from Jean Renoir, which was called Nouvelles Éditions, Éditions Françaises, which was linked to Gallimard, the publishing house. Because Gallimard, so it's a chain, it's interesting. So you had Gallimard, Nouvelle Revue Française. That's a collection of Gallimard, which is the collection which aesthetic influenced me when I did my packaging. Then Renoir was influenced by Gallimard, and then my father and uncle were influenced by Renoir for their names. And I was influenced by, when I called my company Nouvelles, at the beginning I called it Nouvelles Éditions de Parfum, and then I called it Éditions de Parfum Frédéric Malle. I simplified it. But it's this world which is very gauche, very Parisian, of literature and film, and this idea of publishing art that influenced my company. Now, to go back to your question, there was something magical in being brought up among this family, is that we were sort of away from adults. Sometimes we were in, but they were very much together, and they were my father and his brothers sort of often at my house, exchanging ideas and being curious about everything, for what they read. My father read about one book a night because he didn't sleep. So, and he read very fast. So it was about their reading, what they had seen. It seemed as a child that they knew everything. And so that is humbling as a child, but it's also, I mean, it can make you feel very, very small for the rest of your life, but then it also entices you to be quite curious. And once you become curious and hungry for information and new things, and especially artistic ones, then you realize that, you know, culture accumulates, and it's not such an impossible world to get into. You're always less cultivated and less intelligent than some others, but you are sometimes more also. I mean, it's, you know, everything is relative. As for cinema, to finish, we had this magical thing with my brother Guillaume and I, is that we could walk into any cinemas in Paris for free.
Oh.
And so because my father being Louis' producer, he had this thing, this pass, which we borrowed and went around. And so we watched about 2 to 3 movies every weekend. So we were at boarding school, we'd come back on the weekends, and we'd spend our weekend going to the movies. And so we saw a lot, and we saw many things that, we watched many movies that we were not supposed to watch.
I was not
supposed to watch Fellini's Casanova at 12. I mean, and being so fascinated that I went 3 times. And when my brother wanted to see Jacques Demy's Peau d'Âne, which was for children. But it sort of taught us a lot. And I was also obsessed by photography then. And I started, my uncle Louis gave me a camera when I was 12, one of his old Pentax camera, I remember. And I started taking pictures then. And this very, very photographic way of seeing life, and this very cinematic way of seeing life, is something that I really developed then. It was way more important for me than perfume. And at the beginning, I wanted to become an art director and link perfume to imagery to perfume. And then I got to work with perfumers and fell into that. And I had found my calling. But it's really, I always link perfume to people and perfume to images. I've always done that. I mean, this is, and thank you for asking this question, because this is really, you know, people always talk about the fact that, you know, I came from a family that were in the perfume industry. the cinema part is crucial to my upbringing.
Before we return to the program, a word from our sponsor, Lumens. As a design editor and magazine veteran for decades, I can remember keeping so many lists. Where to buy lighting, where to buy great furniture, rugs, accessories, pillows, vases, you name it. Just keeping track of where to get access to the best design houses online was a job unto itself. But today, homeowners and designers have access to Lumens.com, a source for more than 400 global brands, all in one place. What started as an insider's go-to source for lighting has emerged as an encyclopedic powerhouse of good design, celebrating its 20th anniversary, offering nearly everything an architect, designer, or aficionado could require, from iconic names like B&B Italia and Floss to Carl Hansen and Nani Marquina. When designing any space, you have to think about color, shape, movement, light, and of course, sound. Take it from someone who records a podcast in a busy New York building. But have you considered scent? I'm somewhat of a candle obsessive myself, but don't forget about the design element of it too. You'll need the right dishes to hold those little flames, as well as all of the accessories like candelabras, hurricanes, and more. You'll find all of these things on Lumens.com, from scented candles to unexpected candle holders like those from Otto Copenhagen that use reflective surfaces to make that candlelight really shine. Or maybe you just need an upgraded tea light from Buster & Punch. So visit Lumens.com to ensure your home or project really glows. That's Lumens.com. And, you know, you mentioned before that you wanted to go into advertising, and I think you worked a little bit in that field and maybe even photography before, you know, after graduation and before you sort of got into the perfume business. Can you tell me how that shift happened? You know, how you kind of tried that and what eventually pulled you? Was there some sort of natural gravity that kind of pulled you into that? Or
yeah, it is a sort of natural gravity that sort of pulled me in. It's true that although perfume was always in the back of my head, and I was very much, after school, after NYU, I was very much looking up to a man who was the art director of Chanel, who was called Jacques Helleux, who was a very good art director, who was one of my father's friends and who sort of gave me many advice, and I had many conversations with him. And I wanted to be sort of him, but he was sort of unique. And I was also hesitant between embracing a career in photography, but yet I wasn't sure that I was an artist. I knew that I knew how to work with artists, but being an artist is quite different. So I needed to work. So I went into advertising thinking that it would be a good sort of business school for me, and a way to learn about marketing and communication, and blending that with imagery. And it did. I mean, I learned a hell of a lot in these 3 years. But then I wanted to go on. I was still hesitant. And I met this man who was running the best lab in the industry, and certainly the most creative one, which was responsible for making one fine fragrance out of two that were coming on the market. We had this huge market share, from Opium to Obsession to Poison to Oscar La Renta to Lulu. I mean, all of these were coming from that lab. So the lab was called Roux. Earlier in the conversation, I spoke about Coty inventing most of the fragrance architectures. And I suppose that the other half, or another big chunk of those architectures, Fracas, L'Air du Temps, all these very innovative perfumes from the days, were coming from Roux. And they had a perfumery school. They had the best perfumers around. They didn't pay as well as others, so I suppose that they fed their competitors with talent. But it was the school. And that man called Jean Amic was seen as the guru of the industry. And he asked me to become his assistant after going to through a perfume education, a little bit at the school, and a lot sort of being locked in at the office and learning how to smell, basically. And I spent 6 years there and learned my trade there. But I always saw this business as a craft and a craft that you need to learn. And that's why I'm always quite uncomfortable with marketing people that have been selling soap and detergents, potato chips, or cat food, and then get into perfumery because you or car and get into perfumery because yes, there are skills to sell, but those recipes don't always apply. And it's not as simple as that. And it's still an artistic business. And it's a business, it's a trade that you have to learn. So I wanted to learn about communication, photography, printing, making perfumes, designing bottles. And so getting into the lab at the beginning for me was something that I was curious to learn in case I would be worthy of becoming an art director in perfumery. And then a few days after getting into this lab, I realized that I had found my calling. And it was a very strange thing. It was like, not many people are so lucky that they find their calling. And it felt completely natural. And I never left. And then after that, when I started Edition Parfum, I used the skills that I learned in advertising and in photography. It all sort of fell together. And also, the fact that I'm convinced that we live in coherent worlds where politics inform music that inform any kind of aesthetic things. And we have those styles that sort of morph and influence one another. And perfumery always follows that. But we are very much the result of a moment. And so having learned art history, working in advertising, working in perfumery, allows me to sort of connect perfumes and images to the world that I live in, or to a certain group of people that I live in. I understand a bit like people using analogies. I understand the connections between various elements of a perfume and the rest of the world. I mean, I can connect things. And I think that because I have learned every single elements of the trade, I'm able to do that. And I feel very fortunate for that.
And, you know, when you decided to strike out on your own, was there something, you've kind of alluded to this, but was there something that you felt was needed in the industry that you were trying to work against? You know, you mentioned like the marketers and all that kind of thing. Can you tell me about how you thought you were going to be a success right away and the sort of the unique sort of editorial vision that you had for the brand, which you kind of continue to this day?
So I had... It sounds really corny, but I'm one of the rare people that can say that I had an epiphany. I hate that word. It's such a cliche. It's atrocious. I hear myself saying it. It's horrible, but it happened. So I had a big chance in life, which was to work with a fashion designer who is called Christian Lacroix, who was very famous at the time, that had a very, very specific style, which I thought was very perfumistic and that I could translate. And I thought, it was still owned by LVMH in the days. I was developing this perfume with the Lacroix team and even sort of being overseen by Bernard Arnault himself. It was like my chance in life. And we had worked on a very, very specific perfume. And near the launch, it was a very long adventure. It was torturous and complicated. But anyhow, near the launch, I walk into this very famous perfumery on the Champs-Élysées and that had just opened. And I realized that everything is classified like in a supermarket with no service. And my epiphany was, wow, this is going to take over the world. And now you're going to have to make perfumes that can be sold without service, without help, because it's self-service. And this is what has happened in airports and in all these self-service companies. And therefore, the images are going to drive people towards the product, hence celebrity perfumes, big launches, all of that. But the perfumes will have to be crowd pleasers because there's not going to be room for very specific perfumes, like the ones that I had just made. And so perfumery was going to evolve towards this sort of mass market business, and perfumery was going to become very, very banal. And for sure, as a result of that, every perfume started smelling the same, that same sweety, boring thing that sort of morphs as the general taste evolves. But uninteresting. You know, perfume are like people. If they please everyone, they are ultimately boring and they never get married. You don't want them for a long time with you. So I realized that someone had to react and find a system to save a more artistic vision of perfume. And at that time, as perfumery was evolving, also I can say that my friends, my artistic friends I was seeing at night, were not wearing perfume anymore. And the perfumers, the ones I was seeing during the day, were asked to make those boring perfumes to work in self-service environment. And I thought, I have to create a connection between the more artistic perfumers and the better perfumers and a more demanding group of clients. And my idea was to create a bridge between them. And so I created Edition Parfum, where perfumers can express themselves freely and treat perfume like as art. And because these perfumers have very different personalities, we have a collection of perfume that's growing, but that's becoming more and more eclectic. They become the echo of those very, very specific characters, those very specific clients. The thing is that you need to connect these, you need specific stores with very informed salespeople that understand that certain types of people, in terms of, because I believe that we are all not archetypes, it's too broad, it's too specific, it's too marketing-like, but everybody wants to seduce in a certain way. And there are categories, and that's how you, since Greek tragedies to Hollywood, we have these characters that keep on repeating themselves. So certain types of certain characters correspond to certain perfumes and vice versa. So we have created those stores where you have specialists sort of connecting you to a perfume that will fit your character. So in other words, I have found my idea was to create a system which would allow perfumers to be incredibly free and that would allow clients to be incredibly free as well. And the freedom of one group informs the freedom of the other. I mean, it's like a virtuous circle. So it was recreating this circle where perfumery could evolve, where perfumery could be modern, where perfumery could be like contemporary art, and where the more informed and demanding clients would find something that would echo their personalities.
And, you know, for this idea of authorship, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, you know, today's collaborator culture in a way. You were probably a little bit ahead of your time. Why did you feel this sort of need to kind of give the perfumer, you know, authorship and to put them essentially on a pedestal like you would as a book publisher you're simply kind of presenting someone else's work? And why did you felt that was important for the business at the time? And like, did anybody push back against you? Did people tell you that you were crazy for doing what you were doing?
So because we were the first to ever mention perfumers, I put pressure on myself, thinking, why hasn't anyone done it before? Is there like a candid camera sort of looking at me, sort of, you know, I was being really paranoid, thinking like, why on earth no one has done it? It seems so obvious. These people are artists. They're true talents. They're true characters. Yes, some are the geeks, but some are real eccentric. They're all very different. And you talk about decorators, you talk about chef, you talk about all of that, and perfumers are never to be mentioned. And people, most people in the streets have no idea how Mr. Saint Laurent or Mr. Dior has come up with that perfume. They don't even know the existence of those perfumers. It's crazy. And so no one told me anything because, first of all, I kept this extremely secretive. And I had this idea. I was the only people that knew about it were a man called Jean-Jacques Picard, who was the man who was Christian Lacroix's partner, who was a very good friend and a very brilliant mind that I always looked up to. And he also thought very different in a very different way than me. So I was going to consult him. And André Poutman, who helped me designing the first store. And so I showed her my packaging. I showed her all of that. And the perfumers themselves. I know that even my mother, who was extremely curious and probably worried that I would start my own business, because she's not the biggest risk taker in the world, was saying, "Oh, can I come and have tea?" And the minute she'd come, I'd stack everything in a cupboard, and I would give her tea, talk about the weather, and so no one knew about it. But I knew that I was taking that risk, and I was wondering why no one had done it before. And it was an obvious thing, and it worked. Now, why did I do it? To me, it was only justice that these people that had been hidden for years would be spoken about. The other thing was that I knew that because it's a very small milieu where they're extremely proud and they want to make the business evolve, copyists are sort of poo-pooed or were in this industry. So I knew that if they were going to put their name on a bottle, they would do anything to be very, very good, very, very creative vis-a-vis their competitors and friends. And so I wanted them to be involved. And the third thing, which to me was obvious, if you have an author, it means that you're dealing with an artistic product. So it was also a way to explain to the public that we were dealing with artistic perfumes because there was an author. And then instead of sort of putting myself forward and saying I did everything, like still some small companies do, because they have such great taste, I thought that it was easier for me to say I'm just the publisher and then letting these people gallop as fast as they want, so that even though I'm very close to them and very involved in the creative process, it was way easier for me to talk about these perfumes as I was sort of slightly detached from them. And so I could say, you know, this is the best, most beautiful perfume in the world. It's harder to say that, especially when you have been brought up like I have been to be modest. It's harder to say that when you say, oh, this is the greatest perfume in the world and I have done it. It comes way easier to say, this is the sexiest perfume in the world and Maurice Roussel has done it. So it also put me this whole company was really built around us, perfumers and myself. And so it put me in a way easier position. So for all these reasons, putting the perfumer's name was obvious to me. It was just that no one had done it before and it just scared the shit out of me.
Were you leveraged? Like, if I can ask, like when you started this business, I mean, did you really have all your eggs in one basket?
Yes.
When you were, as so many people do?
Yes, I inherited a bit of money from my father and I put everything on the red.
Oh gosh, okay. Well, it paid off.
And yes, it did, but I must say that it was not really the best way to get good night's sleep.
Before we return to Frederick Mall, a word from our sponsor, Viegra. Sometimes in the world of design, someone creates a legacy so powerful that it creates a style all its own. One that endures, thrives, and evolves. The French House of Liegre, founded by the legendary talent Christian Liegre, carries on the creative ethos of its founder in furniture, interiors, and yachts. From its headquarters in Paris, with a focus on timeless modernism,
and an elevated palette of materials, textures, and craftsmanship. The latest project of the house is close to the hearts of any lover of travel and design: the Coste Liègre capsule collection. In 2015, Jean-Louis Coste entrusted Christian with the redesign of the Hotel Lotti, nestled between the Tuileries Garden and the Place Vendôme. Today, it's an icon of luxury travel and of Paris as the fashion and design capital of the world. The five-star hotel's redesign was completed in 2020 after Christian's passing, and the collection includes many of the bespoke pieces created for the suites and public spaces. My favorite would have to be the Cambon chair. This iconic piece has a backrest covered in tightly woven straw and exemplifies the legacies of both the hotel and the House of Liègre. Elegant, comfortable, and with a sense of timeless modernity. For more information about the collection or any piece from the extensive catalog of Liègre, visit StudioLiègre.com. That's StudioLiègre.com. And of all some of your more iconic scents, like Portrait of a Lady, things like that, a French Lover, what do you think, you know, you've now that you have some miles on the business of your own brand?
Too many.
What do you think makes a scent iconic? Do you have a kind of, or is it really kind of unpredictable in the way that a book might be unpredictable or a film? But can you identify some quality of an iconic scent that really sort of stands the test of time?
So I think that iconic scents all have the same ingredients, really, to success. One, they are extremely specific and easy to recognize and have a very strong character. You cannot be iconic if you are wishy-washy. You can be successful financially if you have a huge brand and billions of dollars to push it with advertising and keep it current. But the minute you pull the plug, this thing will crash and burn. So it's this very artificial way of keeping fragrances up. And some brands are successful with doing this. But an iconic scent, the real classics, the ones that can survive without investment or with little investment, that people cannot live without, are really specific and usually the first of their kind. Two, they have flawless, usually they're very good technically. They last, so on, they have all of that. But three, what's important is that there is this hard to describe quality where they become not a smell, but a perfume. And what I mean by that, it took me a long time to understand that, is that they become so much part of one's body that it becomes a person's smell. And you don't know if it's the person's natural smell, where that person's natural smell stops, and when the perfume begins, it becomes one. They blend in one another. So it's a human smell. So when you work on a candle, it's not a human smell, and it's fine that it's beautiful and maybe comfortable, but it's not human. So it's a smell. That's easy. To make something that's a person, it's a different thing. So that's what makes all these classics become classics. Now, to A Portrait of a Lady, it's a funny story. We thought with Dominique that the dry down of a perfume that we had just made called Geranium pour Monsieur could be chopped and developed into a scent. And then we had done that, but it was a bit like lounge music or some of those niche perfumes that are just one rhythm and, you know, it's only one dimension. It's a bit boring and you don't want to stay for too long with something like that, wearing something like that. And then we came up with the idea of putting this huge amount of rose and to tie it into this thing, which sort of made us change course, but made Portrait of a Lady. And we thought it was so beautiful and we were so in love with what we were doing. We were frantic about finishing it, I remember, because we were so excited. But on the other hand, the question was that whether in a world which is not always pretty, whether it was too refined or not. And because it was so specific, we thought, you know, it's going to be great for our image, great for the company, great for our pride, but will people get it? And because it was so specific, because it was so over the top, people fell in love with it and it became our bestseller. So sometimes when you take this huge risk, there is this huge reward. But yes, it's a huge risk. It can fail miserably. So there are some perfumes that are in life and people, things that are outside life. I love the story where Greta Garbo decides to go to retirement. And in fact, she was longing to make a comeback, but she never managed to make a comeback because she was too beautiful. She was too grand and no one identified to her. She was not bankable. She was not bankable because she had become a star that was shining so high that no one could think, she could not fit a part. And so a perfume has to be part of life. So the difficulty is, you can make something specific, you can make something human, you can make something extraordinary, but so it becomes a home run, but it still has to stay more or less in the park. It's that thing which makes a perfume magical or not.
And, you know, obviously scent has become, like the rest of style and fashion, you know, more unisex over time.
Yes.
And our ideas of sort of sex and gender and seduction have also kind of transformed fairly radically in the past 10-20 years.
Yeah.
How do you approach the idea of sort of sex and gender when you're talking to someone about a scent? Do you today, when you're thinking about the scents that you're going to perhaps produce in 2 years' time or that you're working on, how does that conversation in your head go?
So we were very innovative almost 25 years ago when we launched Edition Parfum, because we were so keen to introduce the right perfume to the right person that we really listened to people. And I always told the people in my store, we had one store then, don't be prejudiced. Just give them what you think they want. It's not you being the almighty or selling what you like. It's what this person will like. And it's funny that being heterosexual, although having been in the business for a long time already, I worked on Miss Ravageur with Maurice Roussel. I was seeing this very sexy girl in my head. And then the minute we open, many men, straight and gay, start being attracted by Miss Ravageur, and there were as many men buying it as there were women. And so we were completely open to that. And it just reminded me that because people were so prejudiced before, and also because companies advertised a lot, and perfume was always a big cliche, was about seduction. So Obsession, for instance, was this irresistible perfume. And there were these films by Avedon was basically explaining that those men were obsessed by this girl's smell. And so it was saying, basically, if you wear this, every single man is going to be obsessed by you. But you couldn't say, but your husband can wear it too. Because in those days, you couldn't do that. It had to be one side or the other. So they launched a very similar blend for men, saying the same thing. But it had to be the two. When we launched our company, for many reasons, I decided to have no imagery because I didn't want to lead people. And so when we launched Miss Ravageur, it was very easy for us to sell it to a man or a woman. Even Portrait of a Lady, we sell to many men, although there's the word lady in it. And so it's, since the beginning, I'm thinking that, you know, a perfume can be, is sexy, is there are more or less, there are several gradations of being sexy. It has to be always quite sexual, but, you know, there are several ways of doing it. And people of any gender can wear any perfume. So we are, because the company is so built on this idea of freedom, freedom of creation, freedom of for buyers, for clients, that honestly, I haven't changed in 25 years. It's also my upbringing where I was in a family which was very open-minded about all this. I was very lucky in that sense. It hasn't changed. And when I work on a perfume, I know that sometimes I think of a girl in my head or a man, but it's going to be worn by both. And the conversation and my way of thinking hasn't changed in all these years, to be honest. It's just that now we, because of Instagram mostly, and social medias and the importance of our website, we have started putting people and images on those perfumes. So we are a little bit like in the situation of someone writing a book that has to make a film about it. And so we had to say, oh, this is our vision of this, and trying not to restrain too much the vision of our existing clients was a bit of an exercise for a while. Now it's become second nature to us. But we try to stay as open as possible, and so that people can still still project their phantasmas and ideas into those images, like they would project their phantasmas and ideas when smelling a perfume. We try them to be questions rather than impose things. And those images have to be open-ended.
And, you know, thinking about the famous question in Proust questionnaire, the sound you hate the most, I was wondering if there was a scent that you hate the most.
There are two scents that I hate the most.
Okay.
The trash in New York.
Okay.
I remember when I was bringing my daughter to school, I knew which day those trucks would be on different streets, and I was sort of going around to avoid it. Because sometimes it makes me throw up because I'm so sensitive to them.
Oh, gosh.
And the smell of butcher shop. Oh. I have fainted twice in a butcher shop in my life.
Do you know what about the butcher
shop? No, I don't. Huh. But it's something that repels me.
But like, could you eat a raw steak?
Yes, I do.
So there must
be
something.
I eat steak tartare. I love steak tartare.
Huh. But I wonder what that is.
But I go into a butcher shop. I remember the first time was in Megève in the mountains. I went into Boucherie Fabre, plop!
Wow.
I was on the ground.
Okay.
So this both repulse me.
Huh. I
suppose that smell is important to me.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's that's fascinating. I'm curious what that actually is. Before we run out of time, tell me a little bit about your latest scent, Heaven Can Wait.
So Heaven Can Wait is a very odd story. Heaven Can Wait was done during COVID. And at the beginning of COVID, we were all a bit scared of getting sick, partly because of this danger of losing our sense of smell, without which we can't do much. And even losing a little bit would have been like, you know, an untuned piano, that would have been even worse. So we were all sort of calling each other and making sure that we were all okay. And I did this with Jean-Claude Elena, who is a very good friend, and realized in the conversation that he was the only perfumer that could still be active because he was not part of a big lab, all of which were closed. But because he's half retired and he weighs things himself and he has gone back to this very artisanal approach and his lab is just a mile away from his home, he could still work and be working. And so we started working at a distance. He was in Grasse, I was in Long Island, and we started exchanging. And he had this idea of working with warm spices. And warm spices typically last longer and are more centrous than what he's used to doing, which is working with cooler spices. And that are sort of flinting and fresh. And so I was quite curious to see what he was up to. And the other thing is that I had been sort of talking to Jean-Claude so that he would evolve in his style and make bigger perfumes and maybe develop a little bit more sense of drama. And so that was basically him saying, you know, I want to give it a go. And so it's really a bouquet of spice. And then because Jean-Claude has really a strong style, then as often he sort of plugged this into Iris, but it's a very luxurious Iris. It's an Iris infusion. So you dip Iris in alcohol for a long time and then you mix that result with the spice. And then it's warmed up by a touch of vanilla, a touch of fruit, a little bit of musk, which for Jean-Claude is a bit unusual because he's always has such a sharp style. And the musk works like the pedal in a piano. It makes things a little bit blurry and a bit softer. Mm,
okay.
And then, you know, added things here and there, like, you know, a little bit of jasmine, a little bit of rose. And it became, and so these two made the spice a little bit more floral. Now it smells a little bit like a carnation. So it's this very warm spice bouquet with facets of warmth around it. And it really corresponds to this very, this longing for intimacy and warmth and this, yes, this moment that you share with your close ones or that you live on your own, because we were, this was the time. But it still resonates, and not because of COVID, but because people today want to protect themselves somehow, and this idea of intimacy is quite important in this very unsettling world. And this perfume answers to that, I think. And what was intriguing, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, is that because we had time, we sort of let it sit for a while after thinking that we were done. And when I re-smelt it with a little bit more perspective on it, I realized that in there is a contour, like a filigram, almost like a the outlines of the biggest, most Parisian and most classic perfume, which is called L'Origan. And L'Origan, the modern version of L'Origan, then the copy of L'Origan, was a perfume by Guerlain called L'Or Bleu. And L'Origan was a Coty perfume, so, which influenced L'Or Bleu. And then L'Or Bleu became, way later, Oscar de la Renta. And it became all these floral oriental perfumes. But it's almost as if Jean-Claude had, if L'Origan was a big oil painting, and Jean-Claude had taken that theme and done that very delicate drawing with it. And so it's interesting because in the 21st century, looking for new modern shapes, with Jean-Claude designed a modern shape, but it still has an echo of this very Parisian, very sophisticated, quite sexy actually, in a delicate way. Classic. So, you know, it means that you never escape.
And as someone who's, you know, been in the business for a while and, you know, you're running your own house now, what do you think your industry will look like in 20 years' time or 100, for example?
So I think that, you know, we have not invented this business. I'm very proud that I participated to its rebirth, because it was really near extension when those self-service companies started dominating distribution. I think people will hopefully always have sex and always want to seduce. And perfume is really the salt and pepper of that. And it'd be really, really, really boring if everything was on the screen, everything was image, and there was no smell. So I'm an optimist, and I hope and think that this is going to last. As to the perfume itself, apart from the fact that all those too many niche artisanal houses are too numerous and too many sell bullshit, I think this is going to be trimmed, and, you know, we are getting into difficult times in terms of economy, and I think that this is going to take care of that, and only the better ones, the more relevant ones, will stay, and it's a natural process. But the bigger picture is that rules and regulations in our business are going to evolve. They are still evolving. There are so many raw materials that we're not allowed to use because they are not sustainable, because sometimes someone finds that, you know, they will create allergies. We are trying to be, and we have always been as a business, be really safe. And the environment is changing, and we have to save our planet, and there's a lot that we have to do. So as a result, the ingredients that we put in fragrances, that we use in fragrances, are going to evolve. And I think today we see the premise of that with with biotech kicking in. And so because we are a very ingredient-dependent or technology-dependent business, so much so that perfumery became interesting when chemicals got in at the end of the 19th century. Before that, there's not much. Our industry is going to become even more interesting because of biotech. And I think that the colors of the rainbows are going to be different. And as a result, perfumery is going to evolve. But the core principle of using a perfume to be more yourself or to be more attractive will absolutely remain, because these things are eternal, and it will just take a different shape. And then there will be new generations of perfumers that will learn exactly with our method of going step by step. I'm not sure that artificial intelligence is going to help so much. So far, it's not helped in the way that it was supposed to. I think it's sometimes a disappointment. Sometimes to adapt formulas, it might be sort of shortcuts to eventually to turn a formula that is made for to be used in alcohol into a formula that is made for soaps. There are going to be little things like that. But perfumery will still be very much an artistic business. And I think, you know, if you want to be luxurious and artistic, the human interaction is sort of essential. So I'm not so sure that this is going to take such a big role, a big place. But yes, it's going to change, yet to be the same.
And what's next for you?
What's next for me? A whole new life, probably. Well, we'll see.
What kind of more work or less work?
I don't know. Times will tell. Probably more.
Thank you to our guest, Frederic Malle, for making this episode happen. The editor of The Grand Tourist is Stan Hall. To keep this going, don't forget to visit our website and sign up for our newsletter, The Grand Tourist Curator, at thegrandtourist.net. And follow me on Instagram at Dan Rubenstein. And don't forget to follow The Grand Tourist on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. And leave us a rating or comment. Every little bit helps. Till next time.